And that's when I came up with the concept of effective and non-effective rainfall. When you have these brittle environments functioning well, which can only happen with livestock, it can't happen with just fire and technology. That's totally impossible. So when you get the livestock handling correct in those areas, the rainfall becomes more effective. And we've got a lovely example of that on the land where I live in Zimbabwe. We've gone through 20, 21 years now of bad rainfall, adverse rainfall. This year, extremely bad. About 2-3 years ago, the lowest we'd ever had till then. And despite that, and despite all the published figures from institutions saying cattle use thousands of gallons of water to produce, our cattle have produced water. We've now got open water, geese breeding, fish, water lilies, where we have no record of water in the past century.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project. We're a grassroots, farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label to distinguish organic crops grown in healthy soils and organic livestock raised on well-managed pasture. You just heard from Alan Savory, the originator of Holistic Management. It's an agricultural system that regenerates grasslands through the movement of livestock. Alan Savory's TED Talk, How to Fight Desertification and Reverse Climate Change, has been viewed 9 million times, and he's still the planet's greatest advocate for putting animals thoughtfully back on the land to regenerate dry, brittle environments and restore biodiversity. Alan appears in both sessions of our virtual symposium, Break 'em Up, The Chickenization of Organic. Tickets are still available to join us for the second session, which will air on April 7th, and you'll also gain access to the recording of session one of the symposium, which aired on March 17th. You can watch the preview and find out all the details by visiting realorganicproject.org. We hope to see you this Sunday.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I am privileged to be having a conversation with Alan Savory today. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you, Dave.
You know, this conversation came because you responded to a letter we sent out, and you said you agreed with everything in the letter, but shouldn't we address the causes of some of the problems to try and get to the solutions? And I know this is something that you've been seriously working on for many years, and great, let's do that. I want to start a little bit by just talking about the problem, and then we can talk about getting towards solutions, which are the hardest things to find. But I think many people still don't understand the problem, so that's important too, to know what you're dealing with. You propose a conversation, and so we'll see how that goes.
I like that, Dave. Let's have a conversation rather than just questioning me on one side.
Great.
And
great.
Yes, let's start with what the problem is. You say most people don't understand that well. My own feeling is I think they understand that. Where the lack of understanding is in the cause of the problem. And I think it's a general acknowledged fact that if you don't address the cause of a problem, you will never, ever solve it.
Yes.
So let's start from that point and outline what is the problem. What do you think the problem is?
Well, I guess for me, I see a world a little bit going off the tracks. The obvious problem that we face is climate change and as you say, desertification. I'll say it's interesting, as somebody who lives in Vermont of the United States, that desertification is something that mostly I read about rather than experience. And I realize that this is true for most of the world. About the only place I experience it is when I go to California. And they have certainly been getting consistently hotter and drier and browner. And they're aware of that problem now.
Yeah.
So I will just say that for me, tied into this is, I think, the problem of a disintegrating food system, and it's connected to the things that you say, but it's also connected to a concentration of power in the food system that makes the kind of sane democratic problem solving that you're promoting hard to reach.
Hang on a sec there, because you're going into causes now.
Okay.
Let's just clarify the problem. I appreciate what you said there, and particularly that you don't see desertification as a major part of what's happening because of where you live. And that is true of where most of the Western universities are and most of the environmentalists are. The cities are, so they're unaware of a major part of the problem. The problem, as I see it, and began to see it nearly 70 years ago, is that we are, and now we've got the words for it. We didn't have the buzzwords 70 years ago. What I was seeing was what is now seen as global loss of biodiversity. A symptom of that in about two-thirds of the world's land, but not where you live, is that it turns to desert. Desertification is an unfortunate word for a symptom of the loss of biodiversity in seasonal rainfall environments of the world, particularly if they're low rainfall also. So where you live in the world is different from where I live and worked much of my life in the world. Right, so you will get humidity throughout most of the year at a reasonable level, and it is increasingly difficult in those environments to create bare soil, millions of acres of bare soil between plants. Where I live half of the year, we will get rainfall over 4-5 months if we're lucky. This year we've only had 8 inches, 400 millimeters, and it's over now for the next 9 months at least, and we get no more rain. If we do get any, it will cause damage because it's falling way out of season. So these are very different environments. So if we're all in this boat together, we've got to look at it globally all the time. No state or country can be an island unto itself. So the problem, as I see it, is global loss of biodiversity leading to desertification, and with that, increasing mega fires. Fires burning at altitudes and latitudes we've never known them before, and with great ferocity, right? And these three are fueling climate change, all right? So that is the major problem. So let's call it climate change, as most people are today. Now, with that, there are many underlying symptoms. Poor land leads to poverty, leads to social breakdown, leads to violence, war, which I grew up with and was a major part of helping solve this, find a way to solve this problem. So we'll leave those aside at the moment. But the mass immigration you're seeing to Europe, the mass immigration you're seeing into the United States causing such disruption now, the mass loss of confidence in government agencies, etc., you're seeing all over the world, but particularly in the United States right now, these are all symptoms of exactly the same thing, which is the way that policies are developed. So now we've become coming towards cause. So we seem to be agreed on the what the problem is, and let's just for ease call it biodiversity loss, desertification, climate change. Now,
and could I throw in, Alan, that's interesting to me that until fairly recently, many people in North America have felt the problem was so distant that it wasn't their problem. You know, I'm sorry for the people who are hungry and live in these desperate places in these eroding environments, but it's only a something in my head. I don't see it. And yes. I think that's changing now.
Well, it's not changing well enough yet. An example of that I would use, because I'm dealing with people in the UK and have been trying to deal with the Royal Society and various organizations there, and they're promoting things as the solution, all right, which are bear no relationship to the problem, really, or very little relationship, but no means a solution, not addressing the cause, and they don't realize they're actually doing damage to most of the world. Because what they're proposing as solutions, all right, aren't. And if you wipe the whole of the UK, which is perennially humid environment virtually, if you wipe the whole of that off the map, it would hardly make any difference. Because the whole of the UK is the size of one island off the coast of Africa, Madagascar. And Madagascar is desertifying. So if you just took Madagascar and the UK, you know, then see, they're about the same size. But the UK has immense influence in the world through its universities, its role politically, militarily, every way, policy, aid, and it's doing enormous damage, as is USAID. Most of USAID is geared on the thinking of Washington. That's a humid area.
Alan, what would be some of the thinking that is tragically wrong in terms of solutions that's coming from the UK or the US? What are the beliefs that, oh, if we do this and this, the outcome will be positive?
Okay, well, let's get right to that. In other words, you're asking, what is the belief as to what's causing this problem? That's what you're really asking me. So let me start with you. I'm going to answer it. What do you think the cause is of biodiversity loss, global climate change fueling, global desertification fueling climate change?
I've thought a lot about that in the last 2 days because I've been preparing for this conversation. And I've been listening to your talk a lot. And so I can say that I'm convinced that the impact of the dry lands in the world is enormous in terms of climate.
And yeah, but what is the cause?
What is
Let's
the cause?
Stick to that.
Okay, I wanted to ask you that, but you know,
I'm going to answer it.
But, yeah, yeah.
But before I give a lecture, you know, as this is a discussion, I want to hear what you think the cause is. Talk about what the whole world thinks the cause is, and then I'll say what I think the cause is.
Well, you won't like this one, but part of me thinks that it's that there's too many of us, too many people, to
overpopulation,
and so the land is not, well, it's responding as it does for overpopulation of species by having the population crash when there's too much pressure on an ecosystem.
Okay, so overpopulation is one thing causing it. What else?
I think that the economic system favors a kind of production that makes money rather than food.
Okay. Economic system.
Money for a small number of people rather than a large number of people. Okay. So I think the economic system constantly is pushing us to stop growing food for people in the area and start growing some commodity that can be pushed somewhere else. And those the problems it creates are out of sight of the people who are buying those commodities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dave, you don't need to explain them all. Just say what you think is causing it.
Okay.
Overpopulation, financial system, economy, driving wrong things, yes. What else?
Yes.
Do you think fossil fuels are playing a role?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, of course.
Livestock?
The great box.
Livestock?
My experience of livestock primarily is that the confinement and intensification of livestock is definitely causing the problem, in my belief.
Okay. All right. So intensification and confinement of livestock. What? So you've named these. What is the view of society all the institutions in the world, the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, the Royal Society, two of the oldest scientific bodies. What is their belief that is what is causing this?
I believe that they're primarily focused on fossil fuels.
Correct. Primarily fossil fuels and secondary livestock.
And secondary livestock.
Yeah.
And I'm not a scholar of this, Alan, but my guess is that, yes, they would say overgrazing.
Yeah, overgrazing. It's been blamed for over 10,000 years. That's
yes.
not new. And they endorse that.
Right.
And so does the anti-meat movement and the George Monbiots of the world and people like that. All right, so let's leave it at that because I think we've covered it. That whether it's yourself who's one of the, in my opinion, I'm not just flattering you because I want you to buy me a beer. I think you're one of the clearest thinkers I've come across in the whole agricultural movement. Right. So we see what you think it is. And we see what the world thinks it is. Now, recently, we had acknowledgement from virtually all the world's sane scientists that these are not the cause. And that was unwittingly acknowledged, and the media has missed it, the institutions have missed it, everybody's missed it. So what am I saying there? I'm saying what I said at COP26 2 years ago, that we've had 10,000 years of blaming livestock for causing the deserts. You can go back in ancient texts and see them blaming the sheep for causing the deserts that were destroying cities thousands of years ago. And that has morphed into scientific fact, even though there's no science to support it, only belief. Right, so that's been there for a long time. We've had denial that we were causing climate change, and we've had people saying it and people denying it. But I think we can say in the last 3 or 4 years that every sane scientist has admitted or acknowledged that humans, one way or another, are causing climate change. Now, that acknowledgement is profound because science is logical. And if we are logical, if humans are causing it, then fossil fuels cannot be causing it and livestock cannot be causing it because you can't have two causes of the same problem. So now, what are we looking at here? What scientists are acknowledging, unwittingly, in accepting that we're causing climate change, is that we are doing it, which means through management. It is how we manage fossil fuels. It is how we manage livestock. It is how we manage resources that is causing all the problems you and I began discussing, every one of them. So all of these now, suddenly from a plethora of confusing issues around the world, which you see at Davos and SDG goal settings and COP conferences on climate, all of these confusing issues are now coming down to management. That's the only cause. It is how humans are managing resources.
Okay.
That's what I believe, and no scientist in the world has corrected me on that. I said that 2 years ago. I had many, many people on social media acknowledge it, share it, etc. I didn't have one single criticism. But nobody acted. We just sailed on. So I think that's where we need to focus. Now, that question of management, all right, is what, and I'm not a wise man, I'm just an ordinary person, but that's what I accidentally hit on when I was a 20-year-old and joined the colonial service and started observing biodiversity loss, severe biodiversity loss in wild areas of Africa that we were setting aside and managing professionally as future national parks. Now, think of the things we blame, and you blamed things like overpopulation, etc. Today, as we are talking, some of the worst cases of loss of biodiversity, desertification, are in national parks in the United States, in New Mexico, in Colorado, Arizona, certain parts of California, in Africa, where I live. Now, these are national parks. They're being rewilded decades ago, as people in the UK are calling for. Now, how can they be some of our worst cases of biodiversity loss? Eroding soils, collapsing riverbanks, species disappearing, plants, animals, insects, reptiles, all disappearing. We cannot blame overpopulation. There is no overpopulation. We cannot blame poaching. Poaching doesn't cause habitat destruction. We cannot blame hunting. We cannot blame fossil fuels. We cannot blame politics. We cannot blame colonialism. We cannot blame slavery. I'm just mentioning all the things I've heard people blaming.
Yes. Right?
We cannot blame corporate misbehavior. I don't know if I said that one. We can go on and on and on. There is nothing left to attribute this to but by management, by professional, highly trained people.
And in that, you would include doing nothing as a form of management.
Yes, that's called rewilding. It's by some people, rest by others. It's a possible action or tool humans can take that I used to teach people 40, 50 years ago. It's one of the three things that humans could do. That began, as far as we know, about 10,000 years ago. It probably began with pastoralists or with farmers, pastoralists moving their stock to let the land recover, or farmers rotating their crops to let the land and the biodiversity recover is probably where it started. We don't know that for certain, but it's a reasonable guess. But it started thousands of years ago. Now, when we manage, we have to use some tool to manage our environment. And I said just now three things. The belief in the world, which I, with the help of thousands of people, discovered was wrong by 1984, is that we have many, many tools. Well, we actually don't. We're a tool-using animal, and you and I and everybody listening to us cannot even drink milk unless they go to a cow and suck with their mouth, unless they use technology, cup, a mug, a pot, something. You can't even drink water without going to the nearest river and drinking with your mouth, unless you use technology. We can do nothing with all the money in the world. We can do nothing with all the creativity in the world until we pick up a tool. Now, humans, scientists, etc., only have three tools. Two of those tools cause desertification, lead to it. The third tool, even in science fiction, can't heal it.
Yeah.
Now, we discovered that in 1984. Now, how did we discover that? I was commissioned by a branch of USDA, the Soil Conservation Service, to put 2,000 academics and professional people through training from all the main government agencies and land grant colleges. Now, if I had told this large sample of 2,000 people trained in various branches of science and management that we only had three tools, that would have been ridiculed. They would never have believed it. So I didn't tell them that. I let them discover it. And it was very simple. I just said to them, I don't care what university you've gone to. I don't care what PhDs you have, what field you studied in. I want you to just list every tool you've ever been trained to use to influence our environment. And by the way, while you're doing it, also list any of you've used in your private life. So they did that. And we got thousands of things written down by 2,000 people. And then we broke them down into casual categories. And they were fire, resting the land, or technology? Now, fire over two-thirds of the world's land leads to desertification. Resting the land over two-thirds of the world leads to desertification. And no technology even imaginable in science fiction can replace rapid biological decay in annually dying billions of tons of vegetation, can replace gradual oxidation of that with rapid biological decay, which is what we have to do. That's why national parks and everything else and research plots in the United States are turning to desert.
So, Alan, you've explained this, but it's important to just call out, and let's have you explain it again. Why is it that resting the land leads to desertification? And if I can throw in here, I believe that you're talking about resting the land in dry land areas, not correct, in Vermont. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. If we take resting the land, all right, letting nature recover itself, it is, of the three tools we have, it is the most powerful to restore biodiversity in Vermont, in the UK, in France, etc. Anywhere in the world, in Brazilian tropical forests, anywhere in the world where it's almost perennially humid, we have no more powerful tool than resting the land to let it recover. In the oceans of the world, we have no more powerful tool than resting the environment because it's perennially humid. Now, when you come to two-thirds, roughly, of the world, which I showed in NASA shots from space in the TED Talk that went to about 9 million people, right, when I showed there is that when you look at most of the world, right across North Africa, down to Madagascar, right up into across to India, up into China, when you look at that area, far bigger than the United States, bigger than Australia, whatever, that's where the world's desertification is at its worst. Now there, if you rest the environment, and particularly so if the rainfall is 300 millimeters or less, all right, what happens is that grass, not trees, which provide the main cover for soil, they grow every year and they die every year, but they co-evolved with herbivores. Now, if you've removed most of the herbivores, as you do, even on research plots in America, as they did, if you remove them, what happens to that grass? And the answer is it grows, and then it dies. So over, where I live, over 4 months, it grows. It grows 6, 7, 8, 10 feet high over 4 or 5 months. Now the rain stops. Now we've got 8 months of no rain. Now what happens? Above ground, above the grazing height of animals, where its growth points are for protection, they're low, they're not up here, above there, everything dies. But it stands in sunlight. It doesn't decay. It starts to chemically break down and oxidize. You see this on the dark black roof thatch of the outside of the thatch. Look on the inside of the thatch in my home, it's yellow. Looks the same color as the day it died. Look on the outside where it's in sunlight and it's black. And it takes 30, 40, 50 years to break down. Now that, when the growth points of perennial grasses are at the ground level, and I'm giving a very much summarized version, that leads it killing the grass. And you get bare ground. And I showed pictures of that in the TED Talk. And I showed research plots in the TED Talk, etc.
So without
we've known that since 1960s.
Without the grassland being grazed by herbivores on an ongoing basis, that grass actually leads to the death of grass.
Yes, it leads to killing itself prematurely.
It leads to killing itself because it was never evolved to grow to 8 feet tall and then go through that dry season.
No, don't forget, all the life on Earth all right, co-develop together. And that's why I began to have difficulty, even at university, being taught plant ecology and animal ecology, because to me, it's hardly distinguishable what's a plant and what's an animal as you go down in the life forms. And I couldn't conceive of any such thing as plant ecology. And more recently, and I've even seen textbooks written on fire ecology. Well, that's like writing a chainsaw ecology. Look, fire is a tool. It's an ecology is a branch of science. So you can't have a chainsaw ecology textbook, or a fire textbook. So this misunderstanding is very deep. It's easy to see why people didn't understand it. That all life developed together in every different part of the world. It was the same. They all developed together. Whether you look at the deepest oceans, 35,000 feet under the water, where no light ever reaches, and the life appears to be energy-based from chemistry, they still find that they develop together when you come to the top and surface. And the biosphere, all the oxygen in the biosphere that makes life in the oceans and on land possible for the fish to breathe, us to breathe, that all came from plant and animal life, biodiversity. So that, unfortunately, that branch of science has suffered very, very badly from the better minds in the world being attracted to the hard sciences, physics, chemistry, etc., as an unintended consequence of Nobel Prizes 102 years ago, attracting our better minds there, and inferior minds like mine went into ecology because we loved wildlife or something like that, not because we were seeking recognition and awards and Nobel Prizes. There was no Nobel Prize for ecology, and yet it's the most vital branch of science for the survival of humanity.
Yes, yes. And a fairly new science.
Well, it was one of the newer ones. It only began just when I was an infant, really, although Alexander Humboldt had really foreshadowed a lot of it over a century before.
Yeah. So just for a minute to go to grass, because I still think it's important, that this distinction. When the grass in a dry land grows up and no animal eats it, then the way it's broken down is through chemical reaction, which you call oxidation.
Well, it is oxidation, yeah.
Yes, and it's either slow oxidation or rapid oxidation.
No, fire is rapid oxidation.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
So I called that in my textbook, and when I began training professional people, I called the brittle environments of the world. Now, I use the word brittle because any farmer, anybody, you can go do this. If you're in the humid environments of the world and you go and pick dead grass that's totally dead, or dead twigs off a tree, or dead leaves, you can crumple them up softly like tissue paper almost in your hand. There's no sound. It doesn't crinkle and crackle. Now, if you go to the environments like New Mexico, big chunks of Texas, South America, Australia, most of Australia, etc., where I live, if you get a dead twig, dead leaves off trees, dead grass that's been dead for 6 months or more, and you crumple it up in your hand, it doesn't just crumple. It crackles and breaks into little fragments, and you can hear it breaking up. So I use the word brittle because it's brittle. To describe it. So it's in those environments of the world that are the greatest parts by far of the Earth's land. I mean, those areas are far, far larger than the whole of the Brazilian tropical forest that people are so concerned about.
Alan, has there been a growth of those brittle lands in the last 10,000 years?
No, the brittle lands stay about the same. They will only change as humidity changes gradually. So some of them will become more brittle as rainfall becomes less effective, but essentially they're where rainfall was seasonal. Now, as the desertification gets worse, yes, they'll get a lot worse, but the brittle land isn't expanding. the desertification of the brittle lands is expanding.
Yes.
Into the fringes of it, etc. Now, that that concept of effective rainfall is something that came into my mind in the 1961 period, roughly. I was in charge of all research in wildlife in the whole of my country at that time, and we had a terrible drought in the area where South Africa, Rhodesia, and Botswana joined, and the headwaters of the Limpopo River, and about 50,000 head of game died in that. Almost all cattle had died, and we were collecting money, International Red Cross was, for the flood victims in Mozambique at the same time. Now, it, logically, when you look at that, you had the headwaters of the river at these three countries, and the river flowed down to Mozambique on the Atlantic, on the Indian Ocean coast, and their floods were our drought. And that didn't make sense to me. Science is logical, so I start posing the question, why the hell is this happening? And that's when I came up with the concept of effective and non-effective rainfall. When you have these brittle environments functioning well, which can only happen with livestock, it can't happen with just fire and technology. That's totally impossible. So when you get the livestock handling correct in those areas, the rainfall becomes more effective. And we've got a lovely example of that on the land where I live in Zimbabwe. We've gone through 20, 21 years now of bad rainfall, adverse rainfall. This year, extremely bad. About 2-3 years ago, the lowest we'd ever had till then. And despite that, and despite all the published figures from institutions saying cattle use thousands of gallons of water to produce, our cattle have produced water. We've now got open water, geese breeding, fish, water lilies, where we have no record of water in the past century. That's entirely produced by the behavior of the cattle, the management of the cattle, making the rainfall that falls soak into the soil and stay there and only come out of the soil by evapotranspiration through plants or running through the soil to provide wetlands, rivers, underground water. Now, in non-effective rainfall, which we have over most of the world's land now that is brittle, there what you find is the rainfall that falls, the majority of it runs across the soil to give you floods, landslides, all the stuff California's experiencing, etc., to what we were experiencing there in the 1961 in Africa. It gives you that. And what rain does soak into the soil, because some always does, what rain soaks in now leaves the soil mostly straight out of the soil by evaporation, like drying your hair with a hairdryer. And so very little rain becomes effective in that it grows plants or goes to underground water and so on. So you find rivers beginning to, that used to be perennial, becoming just flood rivers and so on.
Okay, so I have a question. You have a generosity that I sometimes lack, which is that you look at people who have made serious mistakes, and like you and me, we have both made a lot of mistakes in our lives, and you look at people whose mistakes have led to pretty devastating consequences. You talk about the many people who were herders of animals, and their actions accumulated over centuries led to the devastation of the cultures that they lived in.
And still is.
And still happens. You don't blame them. You don't call them bad people. But you say, and let's put it in the language that we've been talking about, that they have made management mistakes. And if they had managed the same resources differently, they would have had much better outcomes. Did I get that right?
Yes, absolutely. I try my best. Earlier years, I sometimes criticized individuals. I think you'll find, if you look at all my stuff, textbooks, if you look at my podcasts and everything else, I don't think you'll find me blaming any individuals, because who do you blame for not flying before the Wright brothers did? Somebody had to be to blame. Nobody was. Until we discovered what was causing climate change, as we agreed to call it, in 1984, until we discovered that and a way in which we could remedy it, that was totally unknown. That was like flying. We didn't know how to fly. So nobody is to blame. What I do blame at times is the behavior of institutions, because they have blocked that knowledge. All training was banned. Southern Africa was banned from even setting foot on any university campus for over 20 years. That institutional behavior, I'm blaming the institutions, not the people in them. The people in them are good people. They're wonderful people. They're close friends of mine. That's how institutions behave. So when we get to discussing how we might solve this, I think you'll find that the people I'm working with in the Savory Institute, etc., as far as I know, and I could be wrong on this, but if I am, for God's sake, have somebody tell me, as far as I know, we're the only people in the world that are not blaming and are not saying we have the solution and are saying we all have to pull together, unite to solve these problems. And all we have, which we literally, I say we because thousands of people were working with me, discovered in 1984. And that is a way in which we can jointly solve these problems and reverse biodiversity loss, desertification, as we've demonstrated repeatedly now for 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and institutions block that. Ranching organizations, farming organizations, all organizations virtually, I don't know any that support that. They block it. That is institutional behavior, and it's one of the things that we have to deal with in coming together to solve the problem.
Why do you think that those institutions are so afraid of thinking differently and trying for what are obvious problems, whatever the solutions might be? Obviously, they're problems. Why are they so reluctant to change?
It's because of the behavior, and this we've learned historically. We've learned it through system science and what are called wicked problems. Human organizations, and they're the only way we can manage at scale, when we form them, take on a life of their own. And no human organization is actually a human. And no human organization behaves like a human. So once we form our organizations and we can have the most perfect people in the world in them, that doesn't matter. They have ceased to be people. They are now an organization. Now, organizations take on a life of their own. They defend the beliefs of society in which they are formed. And they have what are called wicked problems, which means they are almost impossible to solve. Now, a wicked problem, an example, but not of organizations, would be desertification. That took us 10,000 years to solve, and we solved that in 1960s. But then institutions blocked the knowledge. That's where their institutions' behavior comes in. That's why institutions banned me from lecturing to universities. That's why institutions in America tried to get me deported for the damage I was doing to America, etc. So this is not people being bad. This is how institutions behave. Now, many people have difficulty understanding that, understandably, because academics do that research, they publish that stuff, and then nobody does anything with it, except independent scientists like me that pick it up and relate it to what's happening in history, what our own experience is, etc. Now, to give you an illustration of why I would never blame any individual for that, let me just take one area of our lives, religion. And I'll just, of the many religions, I'll just look at one, Christianity, because many people who are listening to us will be Christians. Now, the message of the founder was incredibly simple. Basically, we could sum it up as love and caring. And for 2,000 years, many millions and millions of people have been capable in their families, in their communities, of love and caring. And we see this over and over again. In hard times, the poor give more than the rich give less, etc. We see this from people just pulling together in war, in hardship, whatever. Every time is a disaster. People pull together, help each other, Christianity begins to function. Now, what happened when we managed it at scale? We found that we developed well over 2,000 branches of Christianity. And for nearly 2,000 years, I think it is now, they've been torturing each other, killing each other, going to war, protecting pedophile priests and the church and not the innocent children. None of that is Christianity. But that's how Christian organizations operate. And I'm not going to talk about the other religions, but you'll find it's essentially the same. It's not bad people. And the institutions that blocked all I'm saying, it was individuals within those institutions that worked with me in their capacity as citizens, as concerned people, as scientists, but outside the beliefs of the institution and the behavior of the institution. So we have to attend to that problem. And nobody is even talking about it at any global conferences.
Alan, would you say that the problems, the challenges of institutions become greater as they become larger?
Oh, yes. The larger they become, the more that way inclined. And the older they are, the more established they are, etc. Yet they tend to be worse. But it's happened to me. Twice I've myself have developed organizations, and both of them end up virtually destroying me, throwing me out of the organizations and going on to fail. Yeah. So, you know, I've experienced it as well. And we're very aware of that in the Savory Institute because we're an institution and we formed one. So we're terribly aware of that. And under very good leadership of young people, they're doing an amazing job. But I cannot tell you how much time we attend to our own behavior as an institution.
Yeah.
So going on with our discussion, you know, if we look at go back to the cause of the problem, I said it was management. And I think every scientist now unwittingly acknowledges that. So I think that's where we need to focus. Now, that raises the question of what level of management, because we're demanding world leaders take action. Now, as I see it, and please correct me, there's two basic levels, what I call the human level. That's you and I and everybody listening and everybody in every institution managing their own family, their own life, people in their community, maybe a small side business, whatever. That's the human level of management. And then the moment we take it to scale, agriculture, immigration, finance, anything, even religion, the moment we take it to scale, we can only manage through an institution or organization. So that is where we've got to look at the management. Now, if you were to say to a world leader, the governor of any state or whatever, this is what we need to attend to, again, that seems impossible. There's too much. How can I attend to this? Behavior of institutions, management of everything in agricultural policy, I'll just pick one. The answer is no, we can distill it down better. So what I did in the COP26 talk, which anybody can look at, it's 12 minutes, very short, is I said, let's look at what we manage and what we don't manage. And everything that we make or produce, we do not manage. We make or produce it. Now, that comes around to almost everything that your members are doing. They're producing food, whether it's meat, cheese, milk, wine, I don't care. They are producing food. They're not managing it. They're producing it. If they stop producing it, it stops. They can choose to produce cheese or wine, grain or potatoes or whatever, right? You can make independent choices. So that's not where the problem lies. With the millions and millions of things humans produce, from music to bombs to computers to buildings to roads to vehicles to planes to food. So where does the problem lie if management is the problem? Well, it lies in the three things humans manage. And I mentioned we only had three tools and why we have to consider including livestock as a tool. I mentioned that, but now what about the things we manage? What humans manage is ourselves. We don't produce, we manage our families, right? We manage economies because we've got to finance our families. And we manage our environment or nature to produce everything. Bombs, planes, computers, food. So you're managing three things. Now, at scale, you can only do that through institutions. So at scale, agriculture, anything, you manage institutions and they finance themselves and grow, etc., as institutions. And through those, you manage nature to produce food or whatever. So you're managing these three things. Now, you cannot choose to manage your family or an institution independent of the economy. You can't choose. You have to manage them together. Now, when you're managing your family and the economy or the institution and financing the institution, now you're going to manage nature to produce food or produce everything. You cannot choose to ignore the economy and manage nature. Ignore your family, just look at the economy and nature. You have to manage the three inseparably together. And that's what we discovered a way to do in 1984. So there isn't a solution. There isn't a silver bullet. All these organizations promoting solutions in regenerative agriculture, in normal agriculture, in immigration, in COVID, or whatever you like, all these people promoting solutions are not. What they're doing is promoting their way of producing something. So what we're saying is, as a Sabre Institute, is why don't we just get together? And what we have developed with lots of people is a way for us to work together so that jointly we develop real solutions.
And what you're describing is what you would call a holistic approach, because it's...
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not, because we would be arrogant if we thought we were the first in the history of the world to take a holistic approach or to think holistically. There's lots of evidence that past civilizations way back, thousands of years ago, thought more holistically than we do today, saw their connection to the environment more than we did today. There's talk about Native Americans thinking seven generations ahead as they managed rivers and whatever resources. So this ecological ignorance is more a thing of universities and modern science, Western world, than ancient societies. So, but those ancient societies made decisions exactly like we do today. And where they didn't have laws and regulations, they had taboos, which were their equivalent. But they developed those exactly as we did today. And that's what we discovered in 1984, is humans have always made management decisions in the exact same way.
Okay.
So what we have to do is not take a holistic approach. That won't help us. What we have to do is to actually manage holistically.
Okay.
That's very different.
And to you, managing holistically would be bringing together those three legs.
Yes. Now, how do we do it is the issue. And we're getting into deep, stormy water and difficulty for me, because I'm going to use the analogy of a bicycle. If you and everybody listening had never known of a bicycle, And you are now asking me and saying, okay, I get it. We can use a bicycle to go much faster, much more energy efficient. But for God's sake, this thing just has two little tires. It just balances. I didn't believe this. Explain it to me. So the more I explain to you a bicycle and how it works, the more confusing it would become. Now, if you and I had a bicycle between us, within 20 minutes, you'd be riding it. So what I'm talking about is 100% practical management. I'm not talking about science, research. That all needs to be reductionist. It's essential. Management cannot be reductionist, but it is. So what if we got together and just worked together, like riding the bicycle, you'd learn it very quickly. I hate to actually teach holistic management these days. I'd much prefer to just work with somebody and get them doing it. And they always just say, oh, my God, this is common sense. So what do we actually do is really we use a new concept. So let me try explaining that. One of the things that happened to humans is we always assumed we were bettering our lives by management. That was an assumption. That's why all tool-using animals start to try to better their lives. Now, when we did that, we were always making decisions to achieve a need, a desire, or to solve a problem. And conscious decisions by humans, I would say 99.something% fall into those three categories. Now, you cannot take the complexity of humans, society, culture, and all our different languages and cultures, institutions and their wicked problems, the complexity of economy, and the complexity of nature, which is mind-boggling, which have to be managed together, and reduce that in a policy, an agricultural policy, a decision on the farm, ranch, to meeting a need, a desire, or solving a problem. Humans have tried to do that for 500,000 years. All right, so what we discovered in 1984 was that. And we realized, in effect, but easier to see in hindsight, we realized, oh my goodness, what we need to do is have something, a context for our decisions. Because at the moment, the reason for the decision and the context for the decision are identical. So what we need to do is to acknowledge that we will never change the reason for our decisions. I think for as long as humans exist, we will make decisions to meet our needs, our desires, or solve problems. So let's not change that. Don't try. What we'll do is, and this was the most difficult thing to develop and why it took so long in learning how to manage holistically, we needed a concept of a context for management that brought together the complexity of humans, economy, and nature. And they had to be brought together. And we finally got that, and then I wrote the textbook after that in 1984 with the help of a lot of people. Now, in that concept of a holistic concept, we can form it at a national level, a state level, a corporate level, a family level, person working in town, doesn't matter, it's universal. When we do that, we get the right people at the table who have to do it. Otherwise, it's not going to work because people are going to oppose and so on. But we get the right people at the table. And they just start, regardless of the problems, regardless of everything, they just start by saying, how do we want our lives to be? That, just answering that question very deeply. And simple guidelines, 100% how you want your life to be, 0% how to do it. That's a decision already made. Can't be in the context for a decision. And when we've established how we want our lives to be in our particular culture or whatever, our particular family, whatever, right, the next thing we do is we say, all right, now how do we want our environment to be, our life-supporting environment, which we cannot escape? Every human is 1,000% dependent on habitat and oxygen coming from biodiversity. How is that going to have to be? Not how do we want it to be? How's it going to have to be 300-400 years from now for our descendants to live a life like that? And then we describe that in terms of four processes, how rainfall is effective or not, how solar energy flows through biological life, how nutrients cycle in the oceans and the land, etc. So we essentially describe it like that. And then there's a final piece. If we want to live lives like this in an environment like that in the future, how are we going to have to behave? Because at the end of the day, every person and institution is judged not by their marketing, not by their mission statements, not by their visions. You're judged by your behavior. So how are you going to have to behave? And these three things coming together give us what we call a holistic context. Now we go ahead and meet our needs, our desires, solve problems, and we get very different results.
Thank you. So let me throw out an experiment. Millions, perhaps billions of dollars are being spent on something called the Green Revolution in Africa. So coming to your home continent, and a great deal of money and power is being exerted to change agriculture in Africa, I think, to be more like Iowa. And I'm curious, first of all, I would like you to do two things. One is to try and look at that from the context that you just talked about and suggest where that might be misguided. And secondly, to suggest what it would look like from a different context. Is that okay? Just to give people a little bit of an actual example of using this thinking in that case.
Well, let's get you to. Okay. you and I are in this discussion, and you've just said that institutions that have wicked problems, one of the wicked problems is they are absolutely immune to how many billions of people die, how many trillions of money it costs. Nothing gets institutions to accept new information that they know is not new. They know it's wrong. Now, institutions know that cattle are causing climate change. They know that fossil fuels are causing climate change. They don't know the tremendous, overwhelming role of biodiversity loss and desertification. And institutions completely believe that there are thousands of ways of developing policy. So they're working on beliefs that are not science. All right, so institutions are coming together, and they're going to spend billions of dollars on a green wall across Africa and greening it. All right, so they're addressing a problem, desertification, and they're building this green wall across Africa. Well, I can tell you that desertification is already thousands of miles south of that wall. So does that make sense to you? No. That's another wicked problem of institutions. Individuals are capable of common sense and humanity. Institutions are not. So that the institution cannot see that that doesn't make sense. When desertification is breaking out in Australia and America and all over two-thirds of the world, putting a wall across the southern part of the Sahara is a total, total waste of time and money. There's no science behind it, only beliefs.
Yeah.
Now, we could bring those same people together because they've all got the right motive. They're all good people. I know some of them personally. They're wonderful people. Now, if we could get them together on just one part of Africa, and that's what I suggest in COP26, just get one small country somewhere, or it could be one state in America or whatever, just get one small place as a first example, and just have whoever's the political leaders, president, prime minister, governor, whatever, have them say, look, I'm just going to carry on policy as normal. But what we're going to do is on the side, look at a new possibility and just let us facilitate, provide the facilitation. We won't provide the solution. We'll provide the facilitation. Let us bring global experts together, their experts together, their people together, and let's just facilitate developing that policy holistically. And those same people will now see common sense. Those same people will now begin to heed science, and you'll develop a completely different policy that I promise you will begin to reverse desertification within the first year.
So, Alan, you actually know heads of state. I don't. And you know those folks at Davos. I don't.
I don't.
I'm curious. Do you feel that you've worked a lot on this? Do you feel that you're making progress in terms of no?
No. I don't think we are making progress. Let me say that. But we're making progress at a snail's pace when a tsunami is coming down at us at a rapid pace. So we're just going to be overwhelmed. I mean, let's just look at your organization, Real Organic. I believe 1,000% in what you're doing. I think you're one of the brightest thinkers I know in that field amongst some other very good people. How are you doing? What progress are you making? So Albert Howard, about 100 years ago, before I was born, was saying the stuff you're saying now. He was showing it with science, etc. How much progress have you and people like him made in the last century? If we look at the world's population and the role of organic agriculture in that, what percentage of people in the world are thinking like that today and institutions compared with what percentage of people and institutions are supporting or apathetic, which is the same as support, or supporting corporate production of food based on chemistry and marketing technology, where you guys are promoting farmer production of food based on the biological sciences, mainly ecology. So you guys have been going for 100 years. How much has the percentage you are, what is the percentage you represent?
Yeah, I might start crying, Alan. So okay. We're not doing great.
No.
We're not doing great. I know that you're not saying this as a criticism, but I say we try as best we can, as smart as we can be. I once got kicked out of a supermarket chain, and I got a call from somebody who was very distraught that she could no longer buy our tomatoes. And I said, I'm sorry, it really wasn't up to me. The buyer for the chain decided to drop us. And she was almost yelling at me. She said, you must be smarter. And I thought, you know, I'm being as smart as I know how to be. But I, for her, it was just a loss of choice. It was just a loss of what she wanted. So, yes, we're definitely, there's no slam dunks here. And I think you're right that I once asked Michael Pollan, if since he had written Omnivore's Dilemma, were things getting better or worse? Because I was genuinely confused about it. And he said, as I'll paraphrase, but he said, the public conversation and understanding is getting much better. There's much more interest and people are thinking and talking about this, but the actual food system is getting worse.
Yeah, and Michael might be right on that. We're all in this boat together. So we are at a Savory Institute. So we're in this together. And we as an institute are doing, like you are, the best we can. We're trying to be as smart as we can. We've taken a strategy deliberately of saying, well, it's too much for the world to absorb everything I'm saying. Let's just focus on the grasslands of the world, the brittle environments of the world. Because when the first government in the world takes climate change seriously and begins to address the cause, and then there'll be a domino effect because no world leader knows what to do. When that happens, the place in the world where humans will get the greatest return on time and investment of effort is in the grasslands, not the tropical forests. It's in the grasslands of the world where we'll get the greatest return. So we're focusing on that as a strategy and doing the best we can. And we've got 50-odd hubs around in 30 countries in the world now, wonderful people. So we're doing the best we can. But we know, heeding research, Eric Ashby's research, Lord Ashby, heeding history, etc., that incremental change that Pollen, Michael Pollen is working on, you're working on, we are working on, we know that that takes a minimum of 200 years before institutions change. It took the Royal Navy 200 years to accept that lime juice would stop scurvy. Over 1 million sailors had to die. It was vital for Britain's society, the Navy, the Royal Navy. It took the Merchant Navy another 70 years. And nobody was being bad. Those were brilliant people. Our institutions are full of some of the brightest people I know. It is a wicked problem. So that's what we've got to face. But we need to talk about it. Nobody's talking about it. If you don't talk about it, you don't begin to address it. And then what I'm doing personally, because I'm in the departure lounge, when people give me a 5-year guarantee on a battery today, I say, thank God, that's a lifetime guarantee. I'm 88. I'll be 90 shortly. I don't know how long I can stagger on, but I will to the end. What I'm doing in my remaining years with my personal time, because younger people, much more efficient than me, have taken over the Savory Institute and running it and everything, what I'm doing is trying to get the world, one leader in the world, to just be a statesman, rise above politics, say, we've got this enormous problem we're talking about. Why don't we just try to use the Savory Institute to help us facilitate an agricultural policy in our country and have it internationally observed by the media, institutions, governments? Because I think it'll start a domino effect. Because I stress to you, there's not a single world leader that knows what to do. And they've got the public demanding that they take action. What action?
Yeah. Well, I hope that you are successful. I hope that we are successful.
Yeah, I'll be gone. I hope we're successful because Team Humanity is in this together, and we've got to acknowledge that we can't keep competing for funds, struggling, belittling others, advancing our stuff. We've got to start coming together, unifying, and solving this together as we can. It's not a science problem, not a lack of knowledge problem, not a research problem. It's a management problem, and we've known how to solve it for nearly 40 years, blocked by institutions.
Yes. All right. Thank you, Alan. Let me think about that for a year and we'll get back. If still here.
Well, thank you, Dave, for what you're doing. And anybody listening, please just think about it deeply. And if anything I'm saying is known to be wrong scientifically, logically, please just let me know. I have no monopoly on being right. I'm just reflecting nearly 70 years now of experience, struggling with this problem of professional management.
All right. Alan Savory, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. Our movement is growing because you're subscribing and sharing these podcasts with your friends. So keep it up and leave us a rating and a review as well. You can find a video version of this interview on our newly designed website, realorganicproject.org, or on our YouTube channel. And you can join us every Tuesday for a new episode featuring voices from the organic movement. See you next time.